Well, first of all, I want to thank all of y'all for this organization for inviting me today. The pleasure is all mine, especially when it comes to talking about my favorite subject, Duncan Hines. Now, I'm going to talk to you today about the importance of Duncan Hines. As I'll explain today, Duncan Hines means much more to our society than we probably realize. He is not just a name on a cake mix box. He played an important part in shaping our modern culture. Now, as you know, I've written a biography of Duncan Hines. Back in 1997, according to Procter & Gamble, who owned the Duncan Hines label at the time, they said that I knew more about him than anyone else. Now, maybe that's still the case, but that was 17 years ago. There are, however, still a lot of little gaps in his biography that may never be known, particularly about the actual working conditions with his various early employers. Nonetheless, I hope to tell you something today about him that maybe you didn't know. Duncan Hines, you've heard the name, you've seen the cake mix. But for those who don't know the specific details, Duncan Hines was a Kentuckian who lived in Bowling Green from 1880 to 1898, and again from 1939 to 1959. He was known in the 1930s and 1940s as the person responsible for shaping our nation's restaurant culture. He is the father of our expectations that America's restaurants should offer above average dining experiences, that they should be adventures in good eating. If you had a good restaurant meal today, thank Duncan Hines. Duncan Hines was born in Bowling Green, Kentucky, in a house in the 1200 block on Adams Street on March 26, 1880. After the death of his mother in 1884, he was primarily raised by his grandparents on a farm in Browning, Kentucky, about 15 miles outside of town. He attended school there, and in 1896, he attended Bowling Green Business College. But before he could graduate, he was sent west by his doctor for a severe asthma condition. Through his father's influence, he obtained a job with the Wells Fargo Company, which sent him west. He arrived in Albuquerque in New Mexico Territory on December 31st, 1898. Over the next few months, Hines quickly worked his way up the company ladder, first as a clerk, then later as a railroad express messenger, then still later as a relief telegraph operator. In this latter capacity, he was moved from locality to locality in the Albuquerque area when regular Wells Fargo agents became ill or went on vacation. In those early weeks, when he was not working, Hines soon discovered a new place in Albuquerque to spend his time and his salary, a restaurant. He had never been in a restaurant before. He discovered the local Fred Harvey House and was thrilled by the wonderful food they served. Hines usually stationed himself at the counter of the Harvey House. He did, however, make occasional visits to the dining room when he could afford it. But unlike the dining room menu, nothing on the counter menu cost more than 25 cents. Because of his meager salary, the large portions the Harvey House served, even at the counter, afforded Hines the pleasure of eating like a king. The restaurant chain's passion for excellence was unsurpassed, and it certainly set the stage for the expectations that Hines came to demand of restaurants years later. He was also impressed by how clean everything in the restaurant was. It reminded him of his grandmother's attention to good food and cleanliness in her kitchen. And so the Harvey House became his unofficial headquarters when he was not working. In early June 1899, just as he was becoming settled into the Albuquerque community, the company ordered him to move to Cheyenne, Wyoming. Now, in his new assignment, Hines was the telegraph relief man in the company's Cheyenne office. While in Cheyenne, roughly in late 1900 or early 1901, Hines met a woman named Florence Chafin, who returned his romantic attentions. He was charmed and smitten by her, but his romantic aspirations had only one problem. Her parents did not like him at all. A telegraph operator could not make enough money to support a wife, they said, let alone a family. So, to improve his image with them and to show that he was worthy of their daughter, in 1902, he moved 9 miles across the state line into Colorado, where he worked for the Coal Fuel Oil Company, which mined coke and then sent it to Mexico. The next year, in 1903, he went to Mexico for a vacation. Soon after dismantling from the locomotive, Hines struck up a conversation with a local man who saw something in Hines' gregarious and colorful personality. This man made an unusual proposal to Hines. He said he would pay him $500 a month in gold if he would become the troubleshooter in the traffic department for the Green Copper Company, which was in dire need for someone to fill the job. The situation was put to Hines like this. Mexican customs and the natural slowness of transportation resulted in delayed shipments of mining equipment and other supplies. Delays were costly to the company. Therefore, the company was more than willing to pay a good salary to a man who could keep the supply lines open and functioning. Since $500 a month in gold was at least 10 times the normal wage at the time, Hines immediately accepted. He had found a job that would impress Florence's parents. Within a few days, Hines found himself a resident of Cananea, Mexico, working, eating, and living with 25 other young Americans, approximately his age, most of them mining engineers. After accepting the lucrative troubleshooter job, Hines and Florence wrote one another frequently. Hines told her to wait for him until he had acquired enough money for the two of them to live together comfortably. While he was in Mexico over the next few months, Florence told him that first her mother and then later her father had died. They died a few months apart. She said that she was going to go to New Rochelle, New York, to stay with her sister Grace and her husband until Hines came for her. In September 1905, after 2 years of the Green Copper Company, Hines quit his job, took the train to New Rochelle, and married Florence there on September 27th, 1905. They moved to Chicago that same month, where Hines began working for a direct mail firm, the J.T.H. Mitchell Company, a pioneer in the field. As a salesman, Hines was a natural. Because of his smooth, friendly, persuasive personality, selling anything was easy. No matter who he worked for, whether it was for J.T.H. Mitchell or any of the employers who followed him, the company's top clients usually asked for Hines when they wanted to do business. Few employees have ever had the privilege of having their boss drive them to meet their clients. But Duncan Hines did. He had the knack for making his employers work for him, not the other way around. The secret to Hines' whole success in life was embedded in his personality. Indeed, his personality, which was easy to enjoy, had a knack for getting people to do whatever he wanted them to do. He had that ability from early manhood, and it served him well throughout his life. However, when his boss wasn't escorting him everywhere, and before he learned how to drive himself, Hines usually took the train. Sometime after 1910, the Mitchell Company was forced to change the focus of its operations, or perish. The Mitchell Company chose to discontinue its involvement with direct mail and plunge into the world of printing. Within several months, the J.T.H. Mitchell Company became a major printer of the Midwest. Because Mitchell could always make great use of Hines' valuable selling talents, the younger man's role within the reorganized company was not affected by the changeover. Hines quickly proved, however, that he could do more than just sell. He learned the facets of the printing trade and within a year made himself known within the industry as one of its more knowledgeable experts. In late 1914, Hines left the J.T.H. Mitchell Company and started a firm of his own. He and Joseph A. Coyer started the National Sample and Color Company. Hines made himself its president and Coyer its vice president. Nothing is known of this foray into entrepreneurship, not even what the company actually did. But it must not have been very successful because it did not last a whole year. Hines then worked for a succession of printing firms who hired him, in addition to their regular wares, to sell printing ideas to firms that wanted to boost their sales. Now, these printing ideas were the various were the names of the companies on the various paraphernalia you find at home and in the office, such as pencils and pens and erasers and rulers and, if you are alive today, kitchen magnets to put on the refrigerator. The first of these various companies Hines worked for in the Chicago area, beginning in 1916, was Rogers and Company. They employed Hines until late 1927, when Rogers and Company was bought by the Mead Greed Printing Company. At Mead Greed's invitation, Hines stayed with the new firm for a few months with the same duties as before. After a year on the job in late 1928, Hines became dissatisfied with his employers at Mead Greed, so he took a similar job as a salesman for the Columbian Colortype Company. 2 years later, in 1930, he left that company for a similar position with the Gentry Printing Company. In 1934, Hines left the Gentry Company to work as a salesman for yet another printing concern, E. Raymond Wright Incorporated, for whom he worked for the next 4 years. As an employee for all these firms, Hines was constantly on the road, traveling first by rail and after 1919 by car from one town to another. On these trips, Hines usually finished his business by noon. Since he was far away from home, and since he had considerable time on his hands until he caught the next train to Chicago, he spent his time checking out the city's restaurants. Since there were few, if any, restaurant critics in those days, it was Hines' practice to first walk around town and ask several people where the best restaurant was. After gaining several opinions that pointed him toward a certain establishment, he found it, went in, and ordered the restaurant specialty. Sometimes the food was very good, but sometimes it was not, and he would walk out. But when he found a real gem of a restaurant, one that was clean and had delicious food, he jotted it down in a notebook he carried around with him. Now, he did this for a very good reason. When Duncan Hines first started patronizing unfamiliar restaurants, there were several good ones in most cities, such as Delmonico's in New York. But outside the cities, where Hines frequently found himself, it was hard to locate one that had high quality standards, if they had standards at all. In the early part of this century, of this past century now, the highways were littered with roadside stands that called themselves restaurants. Unsuspecting travelers took their lives in their hands when they walked through their doors. As Hines noted later, in those days, more people died each year from restaurant food poisoning than they did from hit-and-run accidents. The reason for so many deaths can be attributed to the ubiquity of makeshift buildings put up by someone who had no experience running a restaurant, but who owned some land and thought he could supplement his income by offering roadside travelers something to eat. These proprietors frequently never gave restaurant sanitation a second thought. The reason for so many restaurant-related deaths is quite clear. Frequently, these roadside restaurants served undercooked pork chops or raw chicken or leftovers from some past customer's plate, or worse. Quite often, they served their guests dirty utensils. In that era, dining out was not always a delightful experience. In fact, save a sanitary oasis here and there, many roadside restaurants were nothing more than dirty roadhouses with a kitchen tacked on as an afterthought. They were unkempt, unclean, and unsanitary. Hines, cognizant of this fact, was very careful of where he ate. One of Duncan Hines' favorite stories about that era's restaurant sanitation was the time he entered one of these places through the back door of his kitchen and found the family cat sleeping on the warm bread dough. As a common courtesy, Hines shared his information with others, especially with his fellow salesmen. As a result, throughout the teens and the 20s and the 30s, an ever-increasing stream of traveling salesmen inquired about Hines' list of excellent restaurants. They wanted to know about the safe places to eat. They also gave him restaurant tips of their own, which Hines subsequently investigated. In time, his notebook of restaurants grew to an impressive size. Everyone found Hines' information to be so accurate that eventually, word of mouth led all sorts of people to his door, all seeking his wisdom before they set off on their trips. Finding good restaurants remained Hines's private hobby and passion for 29 years, from 1905 to 1934. However, in 1934, a Chicago newspaper heard of Hines's expertise and wrote an article on his penchant for finding superior restaurants. From that point forward, his life was never the same. People by the hundreds began calling him and writing him, all wanting to know where the best place to eat in a specific city was. By 1935, in response to the constant stream of letters and telegrams and phone calls that he was receiving from so many businessmen, so many newlyweds, and so many people from all walks of life, he finally compiled a list of 167 superior restaurants in 30 states on little blue cards and sent them along with his Christmas cards. Because he wanted to get some work done, he hoped the list would put a stop to the request. Instead, for Duncan Hines, it just fueled the fire. Within weeks, he was receiving hundreds of letters for this list. So he printed up 1,000 copies and charged $1 for it. He was soon $1,000 richer, but he had not stemmed the flow of requests for the list that were flooding his mailbox each day. He had to do something about this monster of unwanted attention that he had unwittingly unleashed. If people were this interested in a specialized knowledge, he reasoned, surely they would be willing to pay for it. So he methodically went through his notebook of restaurants and from it compiled what became his first book, Adventures in Good Eating, self-published in June 1936. It sold 5,000 copies that year, but saddled Hines with a $1,500 loss. However, because interest in his book continued to grow by word of mouth, he decided to raise the book's price in subsequent editions from $1 to $1.50, where it remained for the next 25 years. In early 1937, Hines published a second edition of his restaurant guide, a greatly expanded volume that forced him to expend a great deal of money on research and travel and meals. This time, he lost only $584. Considering his expenses in creating a much larger book, this was a good omen. The gap between profit and loss was closing fast. By March 1938, the restaurant guide was doing so well that Hines left his job as a print salesman to work for himself full-time as his own publisher. In mid-1938, he published an updated third edition to his restaurant guide, and he supplemented this with a second published title, Lodging for a Night, which was a guide to the best hotels and motels in America. That volume did quite well, too, at the cash register. In fact, when most Americans bought one book, they usually bought the other and kept them together in the car glove compartment. By the end of 1938, people who traveled frequently throughout America knew of Duncan Hines and his wonderful books. At last, they had reliable restaurant and lodging guides that would get them from city to city and every oasis in between without having to suffer any discomfort. Let me go now to why the Duncan Hines restaurant guide caught on with its first purchasers and later the entire American public in such a big way. It should be remembered that Adventures in Good Eating was not the first restaurant guide intended for defenseless travelers. In France, the guide Michelin had already come to the rescue of discriminating French travelers. In America, directories of hostelries and eateries were available. But the American restaurant guides were, for the most part, a sham. They were financed by the very establishments they purported to review. Hines' book, on the other hand, was different from anything that had come before. It was an opinionated, independent guide designed for the discriminating traveler. It appealed to the person who was very fussy about where he ate. One does not automatically think of Duncan Hines as a writer, but it was his abilities as one that played a significant factor in the success of his books. They were not only informative, they were fun to read. Few individuals could so succinctly inspire daydreams of wondrous meals to be had. Adventures in Good Eating's recommendations were laced with Hines' characteristic eye-catching phraseology. Therein, his readers found charming wordage that tempted and perhaps induced one to hop in his car and investigate the culinary delights told thereof. For instance, in Stute's Chicken, a Hot Springs, Arkansas restaurant on Malvern Road that was open from October through May, Hines wrote, "Imported Italian foods especially here, but it is a good old American menu, a thick porterhouse or broiled McFed chickens that has made Stute's famous, and their beaten cream biscuits, the like of which you have seldom tasted." Hines could also be matter-of-fact of this in his description. Of the Hotel Del Mar in Del Mar, California, Hines described it as a little bit of England in Southern California. Love the gardens and English cottages set in a 12-acre park with an adjoining beach. And of its restaurant, he wrote, "The table is excellent. Try the Del Mar lobster or the roast turkey. It will be something to remember." Sometimes, though, Hines could become lofty when referring to one of his favorite restaurants. Of Kentucky's Beaumont Inn in Harrisburg, which remains today, in most particulars as it was in 1936. Hines described it as a white pilloried mansion built in 1847 and for many years the home of the beloved Daughters College. For the past 20 years, it has become known throughout America as the delightful and satisfying Beaumont Inn. Here you will find true Southern hospitality at its best. Their food specialties are fried yellow-legged chicken, 2-year-old genuine country-cured hickory-smoked ham, delicious beaten biscuits, an ample variety of fresh vegetables, and their desserts are very, very good. Designed for readability, information, as well as simple browsing, one could spend an afternoon with Hines' guidebook reading his concise, enjoyable descriptions of restaurants, many of them far away, and leave the experience as a seasoned, contented armchair traveler. Hines, to distinguish himself further, snubbed all offers of advertising. Adventures in Good Eating made money from book sales only. Hines fiercely guarded not only his independence, but also his anonymity. When he made a restaurant reservation, he did so under an assumed name to avoid special treatment. Usually he never revealed his identity at all. Often the restaurant management didn't know what he looked like anyway. Because the American public saw him as someone who was completely independent of outside influence, as someone who cared little about money, as someone who could not be bought, as someone who was only interested in serving his fellow man in an effort to find for him a decent restaurant meal, Duncan Hines had credibility with him. The vast majority of the American public, however, did not know of Duncan Hines until December 1938, when the widely read and very influential magazine, the Saturday Evening Post, published an article on him and his unusual little enterprise. It was an accurate portrayal of him, relating his constant search for good restaurants so he could alert the traveling public to them. The Saturday Evening Post issue featuring Hines sold out very quickly. In fact, it was so popular that the magazine had to print up thousands of special extra editions to handle the demand. The article made Hines a national celebrity overnight. The reason for his celebrity and why Hines piqued Americans' interest at this time was primarily because it wanted and needed such a man. Hines came across to Americans as an average, honest, and sincere grandfatherly figure who had dedicated his life to protecting travelers from what they feared most: bad meals, but most importantly, restaurant food poisoning, which was everywhere during much of the first half of the 20th century. From 1939 throughout the 1940s, as a result of countless newspaper interviews and hundreds of radio appearances, Duncan Hines' influence over the American public grew astronomically. And early on, Hines decided to do something with that influence by leading a crusade to reform the sorry condition of American restaurants. The best weapon at his disposal to reform this recalcitrant industry lay in the trust the public placed in him. In an age of reform, he would be a reformer too. Any restaurant listed in his annual guidebook, Adventures in Good Eating, was almost sure to have a full dining room every night. It was estimated that any restaurant listed in his book would be sure to earn an extra $50,000 to $75,000 a year, which was quite a lot of money in those days. If Duncan Hines recommended it, that was all that Americans needed to know. Most of those restaurants not listed in his book were less frequently patronized. However, it was not easy to get into his book. Any listed restaurant in that book had to have very high standards, and every year Hines kept adding to those standards. For instance, no restaurant would be recommended by him unless it had, just to name three items we take for granted today, brand new silverware, linen tablecloths, and sparkling china. And even those who made these changes and who were subsequently listed in his guidebook were never on firm ground. They had to keep their standards high or else they would be removed permanently from his book. Hines would make unannounced follow-up inspections to see if these restaurants to see if his criteria had been carried out. If Hines removed a restaurant from his book because they had failed to live up to his expectations, Word quickly traveled through the grapevine among other restaurants that were listed in his books. They reasoned that if removal could happen to X, then it could happen to them. And by this method, Hines kept all his recommended restaurants on their toes. Hines then turned his attention to kitchen technology. He said that all listed restaurants would have to get the latest in culinary cookware or be excluded from its directory. They would have to get modern or be left behind. Soon, the restaurants that Hines listed began installing electric dishwashers and doing away with washing their dishes in the sink, which he deemed highly unsanitary. In subsequent years, restaurants added all manner of modern kitchen technology, all to please Duncan Hines, who demanded they keep their kitchens extra clean and purchase the latest gadgets to keep them that way. One other sanitary innovation Hines insisted on concerned bathrooms. All restaurant bathrooms had to be located as far away from the kitchen and the dining room as possible. The bathrooms also had to be clean at all times or the restaurants would lose their listing. Hines had an idea for the perfect restaurant kitchen. His ideal kitchen was one that had only a glass partition separating the chef from the patrons he served so they could watch his every move. I guess one sneeze and the restaurant would be ruined. Because of the economic benefits that a restaurant could reap if Duncan Hines deemed it to be one of the best in the country, thousands of restaurateurs transformed their dining rooms and kitchens into spick and span institutions, all in an effort to be listed in his restaurant guide. Duncan Hines was always offering suggestions to Americans who patronized restaurants who wanted to make them better. And perhaps his most innovative and effective suggestions, one that Americans might want to revive today, was in instructing prospective diners to insist on a tour of the restaurant's kitchen before eating in the dining room, even if they had to make a reservation to do so. Now, if visitors were revolted by what they saw, such as unsanitary food lying around the kitchen collecting bacteria, they could leave and never return. Millions took Hines' advice to heart. For example, in 1948, the Marimore, a restaurant in Columbus, Ohio, one that Hines recommended for years, received so many requests to inspect its kitchen that scheduled tours were stacked up 8 weeks ahead of time, with a limit of 5 customers allowed on the premises during the busiest hours. When potential diners asked for a tour of the kitchen, only an insane restaurant owner would turn down their request because if Duncan Hines ever found out about it, his restaurant would never be included in the directory again. And since no one knew when Duncan Hines or the people who helped him collect his restaurant information would show up, restaurant tours did whatever they could to win his favor. And if that meant giving a customer a restaurant inspection tour or keeping its bathroom sparkling clean or having the latest in modern kitchen technology, then that's a price they had to pay if they wanted to be included in Hines' restaurant guide and reap the subsequent economic rewards. Duncan Hines essentially used his book Adventures in Good Eating as a weapon to reform an entire industry, and it worked. As finer restaurants became better places to dine in as a result of Hines' efforts, Americans' expectations for all restaurants grew as well. After a while, the public's expectations for restaurant meals, wherever they dined, had been permanently heightened. In time, it was simply unimaginable for anyone to walk into a dirty restaurant and feel comfortable eating its food. After a while, any restaurant associated with an unsanitary aspect soon closed down or lacked much business. As a result of his tireless efforts in reforming restaurants and other public health concerns, by the end of the Second World War in 1945, market research showed that among American housewives, the most trusted name in the food industry was Duncan Hines. As a result of that trust, Hines became a valuable commodity. Because of the economic rewards Hines could confer on a firm, just by just endorsing its product, everyone wanted to take advantage of his influence. Hines, however, refused to cooperate with him because he didn't want to lose the trust that the American public had placed in him. As Hines put it, once the public saw him succumbing to money or some other form of influence, his greatest asset, in other words, his independence, would be compromised. And once that happened, no one would ever trust what he had to say again. It was that bond of trust that he had with the American public that set Duncan Hines apart from other food critics of his time. The difference between restaurant reviewers of the day and Duncan Hines is that the reviewers would simply say, "Go here. This is good." By contrast, Duncan Hines said, "Go here, because I am trying to protect you." Now I ask, which one of those statements do you find the more reassuring? So Hines' strong code of ethics forbade him to endorse anything. And this was his stance until he met Roy Park. In 1948, Hines was approached by Park to start a line of Duncan Hines foods. Unlike those who had failed before him, Park studied Hines carefully before he approached him. He discovered where others had gone wrong. They had tried to interest Hines with money. Park found that Duncan Hines was not interested in money. Park discovered that Hines, while not wealthy, lived a comfortable life. So long as he had enough money to satisfy his few wants, he was happy. Hines was far and away more interested in influencing restaurants to adopt his way of thinking. He wanted to make restaurants better places for the public to dine in. Therefore, when Park approached Hines in November 1948, he told Hines that he didn't want to make any money from his name. Instead, he wanted to start a line of high-quality Duncan Hines food products to honor him. This approach appealed to Hines. And once he saw that Park was sincere, he formed with him Hines Park Foods in October 1949. By the early 1950s, over 250 canned, bottled, and boxed Duncan Hines products could be found in grocery store shelves throughout most of America. The first really big product the company had came in 1950 with Duncan Hines ice cream. But by 1952, sales of the Duncan Hines cake mixes began to surpass the ice cream. But the company was more than ice cream and cake mix. Duncan Hines was interested in raising the standard for all sorts of food. Hines Park Foods put out a whole array of Duncan Hines items, including 20 kinds of Duncan Hines jams and jellies, 18 assorted jars of Duncan Hines pickles, 3 types of Duncan Hines mushrooms, and 11 kinds of Duncan Hines ice cream topping. The label also produced, among others, Duncan Hines fruit sherbet, Duncan Hines steak sauce, Duncan Hines hot sauce, Duncan Hines salad dressing, Duncan Hines seafood sauce, Duncan Hines bread, Duncan Hines ketchup, Duncan Hines mustard, and Duncan Hines chili sauce, just to name a few. Meanwhile, Hines was still producing not only his annual restaurant and lodging guides, he was also producing a cookbook each year. Adventures in Good Cooking was first published by Hines in 1939. The book came about when Hines kept receiving thousands of requests to print a book of recipes from the restaurants that he recommended. he made some inquiries and discovered that the owners of many of his recommended restaurants were quite happy to supply him with some of the recipes, if not their prized ones, of course. As they saw it, after all that Hines had done for them business-wise, it was the least they could do for him. The cookbook was made up of recipes that came not only from the restaurants that Hines featured in Adventures in Good Eating, but it also included many of the restaurant of the dishes that had circulated throughout the Hines household for many years. In fact, during the Second World War, sales for the cookbook, for a time, surpassed the guidebooks. Hines also published a fourth annual book, beginning in 1949, Hines began publishing an annual travel guide for vacationers, which he called Duncan Hines Vacation Guide. It was not as big a seller as the other three publications, mainly because it consisted of information copied from state travel bureaus. Duncan Hines' characteristic phraseology was only found in the book's introduction. The travel guide was useful, but not very entertaining to read, unlike his restaurant and lodging guides. In the 1950s, Duncan Hines also wrote a syndicated newspaper column, and he even had a national radio show on the Mutual Network where he and Roy Park would discuss food and lodging. He was a busy man, particularly for one who was now 70 years old. In 1953, however, Hines wanted to slow down. In July 1953, after all his restaurant and travel guidebooks had been published for the coming year, Hines sold his publishing outfit to Roy Park. Hines and Park then formed the Duncan Hines Institute, which, in addition to the three guidebooks and the cookbook, produced two new books, both of which came out in 1955. One was the one that was held up a little while ago, Duncan Hines' Food Odyssey, which was a sort of slight biography and food travelogue. And Duncan Hines' Dessert Book, which was a collection of desserts that were found on the menus of some of his recommended restaurants, as well as quite a few desserts that came from the kitchens of Hines' friends and immediate family. In August 1956, Procter & Gamble, which was about to enter the food industry for the first time in a large way, found it needed a name that would garner instant respect and attention, a name that would garner it impressive sales. The company found what it wanted in Duncan Hines and bought the rights to his name, compensating Hines a percentage from each case of cake mix it sold. I think it was 1/8 of 1 cent for every case of cake mix sold. It also bought the mill in Nebraska that produced Hines Parks' cake mix. Within a few months, Duncan Hines cake mix and a few other similar items produced by Procter & Gamble were on grocery store shelves all throughout America. Duncan Hines did not live very long to savor this, however. He lived only about 2.5 years after the merger. Duncan Hines died of lung cancer on March 15, 1959, 11 days before his 79th birthday. 3 years later, the Duncan Hines guidebooks and the cookbook were discontinued in 1962, mainly because, Roy Park said, they had outlived their usefulness. Thanks to Duncan Hines, Park said, there were now good restaurants everywhere throughout America. No matter where one dined, he would always have a safe, enjoyable adventure in good eating. And from that time to this, for the most part, Duncan Hines slowly receded into the cultural memory of American history to the point that today most people think of him as some sort of a mythical figure like Betty Crocker. They do not think of him as the man responsible for an aspect of life that they take for granted, eating in restaurants safely. Thanks to Duncan Hines, our restaurant meals have become safe adventures in good eating. It can be argued that the ubiquitous fast food restaurant chains that engulf our nation today would not proliferate as they do had it not been for our expectation that they be clean, or at least have the aura of cleanliness. And where did that expectation come from? It came from the man who demanded that we demand that the restaurants we eat in be clean. That expectation, which we take for granted today, came from Duncan Hines. He changed our expectations for restaurant food forever. And he laid the groundwork for the restaurant culture we enjoy today. And it is for this reason that we should be honoring him every time we sit down at a restaurant meal. We should lift our glasses and say, thank you, Duncan Hines. Thank you.
Thank you.
Got through that somehow.
Does anyone have any questions?
One back here.
When Duncan Hines published his books, did he include only recommendations, or did he also have reasons for restaurants not being recommended? Was it all positive, or was it simply by omission that you knew not to go?
If you were in the book, you were just deemed to be one of the best there was. I mean, he didn't even have any recommendation or any ratings or anything like that. If you were just in it, everyone knew that this was a good, clean, safe place to go. Does that answer your question? Okay.
There you go.
Sure.
Thank you. The Duncan Hines Institute existed in Ithaca, New York.
Right, right.
At least to his death. What happened after his death to that institute? Did it just disappear?
I think, let me see. I guess it must have disappeared in 1962 when they discontinued the guidebooks. I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, it would have to. There was no reason for it to exist. He made the announcement in the fall of 1961 that there were not going to be any 1962 guidebooks. So that's what happened there. I think one thing, I mean, if you look at that very last issue that they put out, that guidebook, there were so many restaurants in that thing that it was hard to even get a word in about the quality or what to eat there or anything. It was just chock full. It got to be, there were so many good restaurants around that it was just not, there was no reason to really have one because you could find a good restaurant anywhere. Whereas when that guidebook first came out, you really were not sure where to go. I mean, it kept to its original mission, I think. So.
You didn't say anything about public health in local or federal or state sanitary laws. Did he have any influence on that, or how?
All I can tell you is that I've seen some state house testimony in various states and that kind of thing, where he was advocating that the government step in and this sort of thing. For the most part, though, most restaurant sanitation was local, and they would if they found something wrong, they would find them. The restaurant a dollar or something like that, and the fix was in. I mean, they weren't, the local government was not going to do anything about it. I mean, it had to be something really egregious, like 100 people dropped dead that day or something. It was that kind of a thing. They just weren't going to police the area. They do a better job of it now, but at that time there was no enforcement, a real enforcement to speak of.
Hold on 1 second, I have the mic.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I know by the late 70s the state Michigan Department of Public Health, which is now the Michigan Department of Community Health, but they did have a pretty good, if I recall, restaurant inspection program, and I dealt with some of their personnel, and they had some pretty good standards for cleanliness and things like that.
FYI. Well, now that's in the 1970s. Now, we're talking about a whole different era. After World War II, you began to get a little bit more cooperation. But it didn't, not until the 1950s and 60s really did the kind of government activism and restaurant sanitation, did you really see something like that? It was pretty much done by the local community, by just staying away if they knew they were going to get poisoned. That's what Duncan Hines did. He identified restaurants where it was safe to eat. People went to them. And the other restaurants would look around and say, well, let's clean up our act a little bit here. And pretty soon, you know, everyone started to have better meals and safer meals. I mean, that was essentially it. Everyone wanted to get the economic rewards that Duncan Hines might come in and say, hey, this is a pretty good place. I mean, that was the whole magic of it, you might say.
How were the recipes in his cookbook tested, or were they?
They were tested by Duncan Hines' wives and his immediate family, every last one of them. And I have not eaten them all, so I'd be bigger in this room if I were, probably. But,
so he traveled around a lot in the early days. Where did he live the last 20 or 30 years of his life?
Oh, okay. As soon as he became famous, as I said, in December of 38, and he immediately, in March, actually it was on March 31st, he gathered up all his belongings in Chicago. He lived in a Chicago apartment. I can't think of the name of the neighborhood there, but it's real. It's been destroyed by urban renewal since then. But Hyde Park, maybe, some right along there, I believe it was. Anyway, on April 1st, he arrived in Bowling Green, Kentucky. For a little while, he stayed with his sister there at 902 Elm Street in Bowling Green. And later that year, he moved. he moved to a small apartment, and then while he was in that apartment, he built out about 2.5 miles outside of town this colonial, it looked like a Mount Vernon type of residence, and he erected in the driveway of this residence a huge sign that says, "This is the home of Duncan Hines. You know, this is where I live." You know, he didn't want anyone to have any mistaken. I guess he had the ego, to let everybody know that he lived there. But he would get travelers, as I've talked about in the book. He would get travelers who would be going down the road, and they thought, hey, this is a Duncan Hines recommended restaurant. They would go in and say, well, give us a table for two, and here's a baby bottle, and we need some warm milk and this kind of thing. This is what it said to Duncan Hines' wife. You know, and she says, well, what's going on here? You know? So that sign had some humorous repercussions, Anyway, he lived just outside of Bowling Green, and this is where he printed all of his books, or he shipped them from there. Anyway, he had them published in Nashville, actually. The man from the publishing company would come up there in his car and get the plates and take them back to Nashville and print them, and then he would, the big truck would come by about two or three weeks later. And then they would unload all these books. Duncan Hines would then, he hired several local people, and they would ship all these orders out for all these books. And he would publish these things in batches of 400, 500, 600 at a time. if there were any restaurants that faltered along the way, he would jerk them out of the room, out of the book, I mean. And, you know, it might be a blank space there, but they would not be recommended by Duncan Hines. And he, this is why people could rely on those books if they were updated. You always encourage people to get the most updated thing, because you never knew when a restaurant would go belly up, or it would be out of date or something like this. This is also the reason why he would never go to a major publisher. Simon & Schuster tried to get him for years, and he would not do it. He would not go with them or Harper & Row or any of these. For a simple reason, he knew that they would publish massive quantities of these books, and they would be outdated in no time. So in order to prevent this, and if they were outdated, well, his name was besmirched. And so he took matters into his own hands. He made sure that the restaurants that were in his guidebook were all up to date, and he did not let any people who were not supposed to be in there be in there. Does that give you a rough idea? Okay.
All right. Bowling Green, Kentucky is not too far from Corbin, Kentucky.
It's a good ways. It's.
But my question is, did Mr. Hines perhaps know Harlan Sanders?
In 1939, he came across Colonel Sanders, Harlan Sanders, and he discovered the Kentucky Fried Chicken recipe when it was cooked in a skillet. It's the same flavor, but it was cooked in a skillet. And he thought it was extremely good chicken, and he put the restaurant in his guidebook, where it remained until Colonel Sanders was forced by the highway to shut down his restaurant. In the meantime, Colonel Sanders, I think, was experimenting with the pressure cooker fried chicken. And that's the kind that Kentucky Fried Chicken has today. However, you can still eat the pan-fried version that Duncan Hines first discovered. It is at Claudia Sanders Dinner House, just a few miles outside of Louisville on U.S. 60. It's southeast of town. In Simpsonville. It's between Simpsonville and Shelbyville, right there. And Claudia Sanders was Colonel Sanders' wife. And after he had sold the recipe to the restaurant chain, he built for her this restaurant that she could run on her own, or with her name on it. I don't know exactly how much input she had in it. I guess she did it first, but nonetheless, what they are known for is the pan-fried version of Kentucky Fried Chicken. And this is the exact same recipe that Duncan Hines first discovered in 1939, and you can have it if you want it. It's a very successful restaurant. It's been there since about 1969 or something like that. It's still going great guns. They even had a major fire, and they just rebuilt it into a grander thing. They had a fire about 1998, 1999, right along there somewhere, and burned to the ground. They just built this enormous thing, and still as good as ever. Yeah.
Okay. One more. Go ahead. Okay. Do you have another question?
Yes, I do.
I don't have a question.
Okay.
I can tell you one other little thing that I would, or a couple of little things here. I said that Duncan Hines made money only from his books. Yes, that is true. Throughout the 1930s, in 1941, once he, with inflation kind of eating up that 50 cent increase with the World War inflation, he decided to come out. I don't know if anybody here remembers these signs that on some of the restaurants that he recommended. It said, recommended by Duncan Hines. There are some older people here who remember these things. Well, he would charge about $15 for a yearly rental fee to have those. And about between a fourth and a third of the restaurants took advantage of that. But he made his money from that. That was his little extra side line, just to kind of help take care of the costs of running all over creation all throughout America, as he did all the time. He didn't stay home hardly at all, ever, even when he was in the 70s. And I think in 1957, just a couple of years before he died, he was in Alaska. He checking out the cuisine there. But his wife would travel with him everywhere. And but he would go about these sign rentals would kind of help pay for all that. And when he died, his estate was only worth about $31,500. I mean, he wasn't a rich man or anything like that. In time, I think the cake mix, that 1/8 of 1 cent, the cake mix royalty. Did help his wife build a much larger house. Yeah, this is the funny thing about Duncan Hines. He didn't want any guests to come visit him, and so he didn't have a guest bedroom. And in fact, his bed was a pull down from the wall, and right there in the living room. And that's what they would go to bed right there in the living room. So anyway, that's just a little thing I found. I can tell you all kinds of funny things if I think about it. But yeah.
And he's all in the book.
Oh yeah, yeah. And it, by the way, the this book was originally 750 pages. When it came out 12 years ago, Mercer University Press made me throw out 400 pages of it. And so I had to do what I had to do if I wanted to get it published. I'd been trying for 6 years to get it published, but no one wanted to publish a large book. And it would have been 600 pages or something, I guess. But they could have told me that they didn't want to publish a large book. And they said, no, we just don't want. All right, okay, fine. Finally, someone said something, and I accommodated them. Otherwise, I'd still be looking for a publisher, probably. However, the 750-page version is, I put two copies of it in the Library of Congress. So if anyone wants to read it, they can go there and read it. I do have it on computer still, computer disk. But I don't look to see that ever published, the 750-page version. I do think that they made a pretty good book out of what they did, though. I probably had a little excess here and there, as you always see in large books and that kind of thing. But I gave you far more detail than anything that you could find. But anything that I could find, I put in there because probably no one else was going to write a biography on Duncan Hines. So anyway, it's all there.
I'm glad you did write the book. And I have a question about the types of restaurants that he was referring travelers to. Were there any ethnic restaurants, any restaurants of minority owners, African-American restaurants, soul food kitchens, Mexican, Turkish?
I don't know. I don't know exactly. I can tell you that he went to a lot of Italian, Mexican types of restaurants or restaurants that serve Mexican things. You have to remember now, this is the 1930s and 40s and 50s when we were a different kind of country at that time. Far fewer minorities in owning these kinds of things. But his criteria was not that. It was the food good and was it clean? I mean, that was his mania. It had to go beyond that. It had to fit into that definition of whether or not he would include it in the book or not. So long as it was good, I think that's all he cared about, and that it was clean. being clean, more importantly, even if it's good, I think. You know. Yeah, well, yeah, and you know, this was his big thing, though, and that I, other people would say, as I said, restaurant reviewers would say, this is good. Duncan and I said, go here because I'm trying to protect you. And this is what people responded to, because anybody can say, you know, this is good, but you don't hear people saying, go here because this is really clean and you need to. And particularly after that story about the cats sleeping on the warm bread dough, I mean, you kind of understand about. And I mean, these stories were ubiquitous all over the place at that time.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.